The Visioneers, Episode 13, Destiny in Jerusalem.
Well, now the action moves back to Jerusalem. Mark arrives. He's met by Esther and taken to his apartment in Jerusalem. It is late afternoon on Thursday. The wedding is Sunday. Esther and her team are taking care of wedding preparations, and Mark is immediately plunged into security issues.
He calls Peter Hemphill, who is still in New York, and learns that President Suchinda is leading a push against Palmyra through his international financial operation called the International Trust and Credit Corporation. Palmyra could be in a lot of trouble before the close of business on Friday.
Well, then Mark gets the first of a string of calls from Kamil Rashid.
Yes, Kamil is insisting that Mark call off the wedding. He doesn't want Palestinians blamed for an attack planned by Palmyra. And so Mark gives him a proposal. Look, Kamil, I want to put a proposition to you. You're convinced that there's going to be an attack against us. I want you to try to find out how it's to be done and who's supposed to do it. Ha! There's much sand in the desert, Mark Venture. Oh, come on, Kamil. It's not going to be the Palestinians. You're seeing to that. And El Conde is behind it. He can't have too many agents in a place with the kind of security that Israel's got. Will you try? Very well. I'll call again tomorrow. Tomorrow. And the conversation is over.
Well, now, it's 7 a.m. next morning, Friday. Mark has breakfast with Esther and her team working on the wedding preparations. It's a hive of activity. There are more than 300 invited guests. Thousands are expected to come and watch. It's going to be held outside in an amphitheater. Esther's mother, Rivka, is there. She asks Mark about the threats that are being mentioned in the media.
I can't tell you that the rumors are true or false. There's good reason to be concerned, but we're doing everything we can to ensure the safety of the day. What you can say to everyone who asks is that their well-being is our sacred trust. We won't endanger them. What I must say to you, however, is that you need to have a way at the last moment of telling people not to come if we decide to do that. Rivka has come up to where Mark is standing with Esther beside him. She takes each by the hand and looks deep into their eyes.
We'll do what you say, Mark. But I can already see around you the shield of God. You will win this struggle as you have the others.
Mark embraces her and kisses her warmly on the forehead. Thank you, Rivka. Your courage and that of everyone like you is our greatest shield. He relaxes and smiles at everyone. Now I've something very important to do myself. My parents are arriving at the airport shortly from Australia. I'm going to pick them up. You'll all have an opportunity to meet them later. Keep on with your good work.
Mark's parents, Bob and Alice, are the real salt of the earth couple. You'd probably call them dinkum Aussies, Des.
Yes, and it isn't long before Mark gets some of his father's homespun Aussie philosophy. Sitting on the balcony of Mark's apartment, having a good cup of tea, he says,
"You know, weddings are funny things. They suck everybody up like some bloomin' great sponge, and then afterwards they get squeezed out and run away. Now, take this place, for instance. I don't know all the history by a long shot. But how many times have armies poured in here over the centuries and sucked up by the sponge of history and then been squeezed out at the end of it to run away like water on the sand and that's gone without a trace? Weddings are like that too. People thrown together, hopefully not fighting too much, but just a temporary splash, and then it's gone. The young couple are left with their memories and the struggle still to come. I suppose that's all right, but sometimes I think we ought to put a bit more effort into keeping the show on the road rather than just banging it up at the start. I don't know. What do you think, Mum?
But Alice just says Mark and Esther are an inspiration to the world.
Now, Mark gets another call from Kamil Rashid. He says There's a bomb planted somewhere, and his advice is to cancel the wedding.
Then we see El Condor in a teleconference where his key henchmen are present all around the world. Palmyra is speaking.
It's time to call in our markers. We haven't worked all these years getting into the pockets of officials for nothing. They need a clear message from us, all at once. If they move to prosecute now, the smell will go all the way up to the highest level. Big heads will roll. Your job in the next 8 hours is to make that clear. I don't care how you do it. If you need to demonstrate the consequences of crossing us, go ahead. A few examples will spread quickly around the network. Do I make myself clear? Are there any questions? Yes, one here. We can deal with our own local operations, but this sudden interest in our affairs has an international push to it. What can be done to stop that? I have a strategy. Within 48 hours, the international community will have a situation on its hands that will make interest in us less pressing. That'll give you more time to diffuse the situation locally. For today, just keep the lid on. Next week, the world will be different. Now, if there are no further questions, this session is over. I'll hear your reports in 8 hours.
Something is going on that I don't like.
Yes, but Palmyra has other problems. He gets a call from Elvira in New York.
Carlos, what's happening? I've been trying to get through to you for hours, but these bitches in your office said you couldn't be disturbed. I've been up all night ever since those men came here at midnight. Carlos, I've had some agents here asking me questions. They want to know about you.
Elvira, if you have something to tell me, you know you're to call on a business line.
Carlos, you don't understand. I'm scared. I want to know what's happening.
Elvira, my dear, you should relax and enjoy your holiday. Do you understand me? New York is a wonderful city for a holiday. All of the theater and art, everything you like. Don't worry about business. Everything is fine here. Why don't you go and have some breakfast and call me from the office later? Now I must go. Goodbye, Elvira.
Carlos!
But he cuts her off and snarls into the intercom. What do you mean by putting anyone through to me on an open line?
But I thought Mrs. Ramos...
Especially Mrs. Ramos. Now what's happening with that call to Porter? Have you found him yet?
No, sir. We're still trying.
Why is it that everyone around me is always trying but never doing? It's not even 6 o'clock in the morning yet in New York. How many places can he be? If you don't get something on him in the next 15 minutes, I'll have the hide of all of you. Do you hear me? Without waiting for an answer, Palmyra snaps off the intercom and punches another code into the console. Wolfgang, is the Jerusalem project on track?
Yes, sir. Everything is under control.
For once, someone tells me something's working well. Who's handling it? Harrigan. Good. He knows his business. It has to be flexible, but we've got to keep it under control at all times. He knows that, doesn't he?
Yes, sir. He's got it worked out. We can brief you when you're ready.
Okay, that's good. I'll let you know. I've got other things to deal with right now. But you keep on top of it, Wolfgang. I'm holding you accountable. This is a big play. It's got to be effective. We've got to make sure the blame sticks in the right place.
Now, back in Jerusalem, another key character appears. It's Colonel Aaron Greenberg, Chief of Security Operations. He's the one who had interrogated Mark and Esther after her strange release by the terrorists. It appears he is rather cynical, but he's an efficient military man. He's not at all impressed that the only source for the threats of attack are coming from Kamil Rashid, a known Palestinian terrorist.
Now, while Mark is talking to Greenberg in his office, Peter Hempel calls from New York with news that the FBI have picked up Larry Porter, Palmyra's U.S. drug king, and that the pressure has increased on Palmyra's International Trust and Credit Corporation, which is high on corporation, meaning Palmyra, but short on trust and credit. His other news is that Elvira Ramos has skipped out of New York and gone not to Switzerland, but to Colombia, abandoning the Eagle's Eyrie. After the call, Greenberg seems to be rather stiff about reference to the International Trust and Credit Corporation. He reveals that there is a branch office in Tel Aviv. Palmyra's tentacles are everywhere. He agrees to mount an intensive search for this alleged bomb.
Now it's 3 p.m. on Friday. Mark, Esther, and the wedding party gather at the wedding site for the rehearsal. Esther has chosen well. Nestled in the Hinnon Valley, skirting Mount Zion, the amphitheater is on the site of the old Sultan's Pool, named for Suleiman the Magnificent, who built the walls of Jerusalem in the 16th century. The whole area is about 200 meters long and 70 meters wide. At the northern end, a stone stage with acoustical shell has been set up for outdoor performances. Here, against the backdrop of the walls, and with the old city of Jerusalem looking down, Mark and Esther will make their vows to each other.
The wedding will be conducted by Rabbi Reuven ben Sabbat, the same rabbi who had buried Joshua Roth. He's now going to preside over a happier occasion. However, he won't be alone, and his ecumenical tolerance will be stretched to the limit. Not the least of his challenges is his Christian counterpart with whom he will share the role of celebrant. The Reverend Gordon de Ringthorpe has never been one to take a back seat in a performance. He and Mark had gone to school together in Brisbane, in Australia, where Gordon had been known as the Ring of Fire. As a teenage impresario, he had produced rock concerts that were legendary among a whole generation of Brisbane youth. When he later discovered his vocation to the Anglican priesthood, the musical fire in his soul, rather than being extinguished, had been fanned with spiritual fervor. The result, 20 years later, was a musical ministry for Christ that had packed tens of thousands of hand-clapping converts into football stadiums and cricket grounds all across Australia. When thinking about who to ask to officiate for his world stage wedding in Jerusalem, Mark hadn't taken more than a moment before picking up the phone to call his old friend, Gordon Ringthorpe. If this were not challenge enough for the good rabbi, Mark had gone one step further and asked Mohammed Hussein to be his best man. Now the three faiths of Jerusalem that had many times torn the city apart over the centuries would be presented for the world to see in the wedding of the future, a grand global celebration of the visioneers. The Reverend Gordon Ringthorpe is a tall and lean fellow. His long, hungry face and huge arm span, which is wide enough, according to Mark's father Bob, to circle the fat lady's dancing daughters, and his long, loping stride give him the appearance of the world's largest stick insect, as some of his less kind associates had dubbed him. Dressed today in green corduroy slacks and sweater of many colors, he seems well content to maintain the image. This is his first visit to the Holy City, and he leaps onto the stage fresh from a feast of sightseeing. "Jerusalem the Golden!" shouts. "My word, Rabbi, the very stones sing with spirit. What a privilege, what an opportunity to present this to the world in the love of Mark and Esther. Friends, this is going to be a smash."
Well, the stage is set for something extraordinary to happen, something wonderful. But then there's this danger in the background.
Yes, and to remind us about that, Mark gets another call from Camel Rashid. Mark tells him that of Greenberg's soldiers conducting a thorough search for the bomb. But Camel is not impressed.
"Ha! You're more foolish than I thought to put your trust in the Israelis. Listen, Camel, I'm putting my trust in a lot of people, you included. I'm assuming you won't let me down. The stakes are too high here for anything less than total effort. If we work together, we can get through. I've told Greenberg what you're doing. Why don't you contact him direct and coordinate your effort?" "I'd rather go to bed with a serpent." "Camel, the only time I have any doubt about our ability to get through this is when I hear stuff like that. I don't want to be the meat in the sandwich between you and Greenberg. Why can't you trust each other?" "Some things just aren't possible, even for you, Mark Venture. Now I must go. I'll contact you again tomorrow."
Now, it's Friday evening, and we get a quiet interlude. The Sabbath has begun. Mark and his parents join with Esther and her family at her parents' apartment. Esther's father, Tevi, is speaking about peace, a great contrast to the tension that Palmyra is bringing to the event.
"So now, could we all join hands here before we eat our meal together and sing a lovely Jewish song about peace? It's a simple message, The Jewish people have always loved peace. We want it in our homes and on the street and everywhere we go. We want the weak and the strong, the small nations and the large, to live together in harmony. We look forward with great hope to the day when there'll be peace all over the world. As Mark and Esther, through their love and work, bring that day closer, let us sing together.
Heivenu shalom aleichem, heivenu shalom aleichem, heivenu shalom, shalom, shalom aleichem. Everyone begins to sing the haunting melody. Then the others join in, picking up the tempo, raising their voices to a fast-paced crescendo, then suddenly letting it drop away as they begin slowly to step to the words. Then, as the tempo rises, they break into a dance, picking it up until the voices and the feet of all the bodies in the room are joined in a great dancing chorus for Shalom Aleichem, as mothers and fathers and sons and daughters, husbands and wives, sing and dance for peace among us and with us and upon us forever. At the end of it, breathless and excited, Bob Venture, looking taller and straighter now than he has been all day, puts an arm around Tevi's shoulder, waves with the other arm to everyone in the room, saying,
"If there's one thing Mum and I have learned by coming all these thousands of miles, it's that this great argumentative, contrary place we call the world can be a decent, happy family if we just give it half a chance. So shalom, shalom, shalom to all of you, and great bonza good luck too."
But the evil threat of Palmyra is not far away. At 11 p.m., Mark speaks by phone to Peter Hemphill. It's the end of a working day in New York, and Peter is getting ready to leave to fly to Jerusalem. His news is not good.
"This morning, it seemed as if we might have had a shutdown order coming out against his international banking operation in several European countries at least. But by late morning here and close of business there, things seem to have changed. There's a report, too, on the London Evening News about the body of a prominent British financier found floating in the Thames, and another one from Paris of a French politician blown up with a car bomb. Both can be linked to Palmyra's International Trust and Credit Corporation. I don't know, but it seems to me that Palmyra's network is beginning to give out some hard messages. It's going to take a lot of political guts to blow the lid on this operation. Nothing's likely to happen now until the week after the weekend. It looks like you're going to go into your wedding celebration with El Condor still in his eyrie, watching you."
Next morning, Saturday, in Jerusalem, all seems peaceful. Mark and Esther go to visit their friends, the Visioneers, who have all assembled together in a lovely guest house on the outskirts of Jerusalem. This is the last time for all the Visioneers to be together before the wedding. They're all there just as they were the first time in the Visioneering room. It's a touching moment, and Esther speaks as she and Mark are about to leave. "Dearest friends, what can we say but thank you? Thank you for being who you are and for coming here to be with us. When we began, who could know, who could see exactly where we might go? Visioneers and adventurers, all of us, brought together and set loose to create a new reality now unfolding and coming together in a parade of hope for the whole world. What we've already done can never be taken away. What we can still do together, and with the millions who have been touched by our dream, will be the wonder of the new millennium. Thank you for coming. God keep and care for you as precious souls. With all our hearts, from both of us, shalom."
But the threats of danger won't go away. Later in the day, Mark gets another call from Camel.
"You must stop now, Mark Venture. It's out of control. It's too dangerous. Your safety can't be insured. It'll be a terrible tragedy. Cancel the ceremony now while you still have the time." "Camel, why do you always start out this way? Why don't you tell me what you're doing to strike at the core of this business rather than giving me these doleful warnings? What new information have you got? Who are these people supposed to be, and what are we supposed to be afraid of? How are they going to strike? How can we get to them first? How do we stop them and not run away from them? Give me some facts, man, not more of your warnings." "Facts? You want facts among a forest of lies.
I told you before, it's all shadows and illusions. But one thing is clear. The wedding is going to be attacked. How? There's no bomb planted. Nothing's been found. The area's sealed. Nothing can get past security. How are we to be attacked?
We've been told that because of the added security that you've brought in, the attack will now be by snipers.
When Mark relays this to Greenberg, the colonel is even more skeptical than ever. Camel says that the attack is to be masterminded by a man called Harrigan. Greenberg knows him and says he will try to pick him up.
After that, Mark feels a need to go down to the wedding site alone. The soldiers and other people are there efficiently going about their work. But he is decidedly troubled. He thinks of Esther in her white wedding dress within the rifle sights of a sniper. And the thought brings a wave of abhorrent terror flooding through his mind and body. He trembles with a passion of raw, undiluted rage.
Mark, Mark, why are you so troubled?
He looks around, startled. He had thought himself alone. He sees no one. Perhaps one of the soldiers. But no, they don't know him. Did he just imagine it?
Mark, this is no time for doubt. You're on the threshold of your greatest achievement.
He turns again, looking the other way. And there, standing a little above him, to the left, on a rough outcrop of rock, he sees the saffron-robed figure of Baba Satchananda.
Baba, is that you? Are you here? Of course. Why would I miss the most joyous celebration of our time?
Is it, Baba? Up until this moment, I would have agreed. I've been pushing on regardless, convinced that nothing could hurt us, just as I was before Luis was killed. And now here... Oh, Baba, I've just seen Esther up there on the stage in the rifle sights of some monster that would destroy her and me and everything we stand for. Mark, Mark, now listen to me. That can't happen. Not now. Not if you keep on the journey you've begun. Keep your mind fixed on what you've said to the world in so many ways now, about love and life, and the great vision for humanity of reaching to preserve the earth and all its treasures. They're not the words or thoughts of one who would falter now, even in the face of the greatest peril. Oh, yes, I've said all that, and I know it's true in the larger perspective. But here, now, in the telescopic focus of a sniper's rifle aimed at the heart of the most precious life for me on Earth. How, Baba, can I take that risk? What have I gained if I hold up a symbol to the world and lose a treasure that will break my heart and crack my soul? It's too much, Baba. It's just too much. This time the world is asking more than I can afford to risk. For leaders of true greatness, Mark, the world can never ask too much. For such men and women are not shaken by the world. Rather, they shape the world with their vision. They drive unerringly to the heart of all that matters, and in the fierce intensity of their courage, they gather to them a force so strong that evil can't endure in the face of it. They're locked unshakably into the rightness of what they do. Their power while on this course is unassailable. They have seen and grasped the star of truth, and while they hold it, nothing on earth, no force of mind, machine, or physical strength, nothing can prevail against them. You must see now, Mark, that on such a course you're truly aimed, and it would be a crime against moral order for you to deviate one degree. You're in charge here. Your leadership strength is undisputed. It's gathering all the energy it needs for success around it. You're in the vortex of a changing paradigm to shape the future of the world, and I'm here to tell you that this is your time. This hour is yours. After you, there'll be others whose time will be then. But yours is now, and you cannot, must not, will not flinch from doing what you know you must do.
Never before in their several encounters has Baba spoken to Mark with such intensity. Through the exchange, neither man has moved one step from his position. Between them now is a force so strong that Mark instinctively feels that he could reach out his hand and grasp it in his palm like a red-hot rod of steel. Staring across into the fathomless depths of the brown eyes opposite him, he asks one last question.
Tell me, Baba, that if I do as you say, that if I hold unshakably to the course that I believe to be true, if I do that, tell me that Esther will be safe.
Baba surveys him steadily for several moments without answering. Then even before he hears the words, Mark knows the answer in his mind.
In such a time as this, my good, strong friend, there are no questions, only answers. Go now and do what you know you must do. The rest will follow as it will.
For a moment longer, Mark stands transfixed by the energy of their exchange. Then he nods, turns away, and heads back across the amphitheater to his waiting car. That evening, Mark and Esther go to a press conference and reception hosted by Israel's Minister of Culture. On the way, they share their thoughts in the car about what they should do about the wedding. He tells her he has seen Baba. Then he continues.
Esther, I wish I could tell you that we have perfect security for tomorrow, but I can't. Greenberg is doing everything he can, but the risk is still there.
You've heard something more from Camel?
Yes. He's still advising us to cancel. If Greenberg had his way, I think he would prefer that too.
And what about you, Mark? What do you think?
I think, my darling, that the world is waiting for us. We're in a flow from which we mustn't turn away. Staying in that flow with a sure sense of what we're about is the greatest guarantee we have of safety and success. She reaches across and takes his hand.
I think so too. This is the first real test of our strength and determination to continue with what we know is right. My mind is clear. It's clear with the energy of everything around us. I can see us shining with success in everything we do. I know you're worried, darling, and I am too. But more than that, I'm certain we're meant to carry on and show the world what our love and our lives really stands for. The press conference goes off well. Then they are taken into this grand reception by Anton Salman, Israel's Minister of Culture. It's a magnificent affair. All of the dignitaries who have gathered for the wedding are there, including Cardinal Vacciano, who has presided at the memorial service for Luis Valdez. He has a special message for them.
We are well met again, Mark, this time on a much happier occasion. Esther, you are an inspiration to the world. May I offer you both the very best wishes of the Holy Father and myself. The impact you're having on the spiritual life of the world does not go unnoticed, even in the somewhat rarefied atmosphere of the Vatican. And your choice of Jerusalem as the setting for your betrothal is particularly symbolic. We're delighted to be part of your celebration.
Thank you, Your Eminence. You do us great honor.
And you're keeping excellent company with the rabbi and the Reverend Gordon. If our wedding does nothing more than create an opportunity for you three to set the world straight, that will be enough. Ah, wouldn't you just know? We've already begun drafting the Jerusalem Declaration of Fellowship on the Mount. We should have the first draft of it ready to try out on the world tomorrow. That is, of course, adds the rabbi with a twinkle in his eye, if we think the world is ready for it. I have a suspicion, and Cardinal Vacciano smiles wistfully, that as the world witnesses this ecumenical Jewish-Christian wedding, that it just might decide it's ready to cross more barriers than most of us ever dreamed were possible.
Shortly after that, Esther takes the opportunity to deliver a special message from her heart as an Israeli citizen to the world. When you set your face towards a dream, it sometimes seems a little hard to make the footsteps follow. It is then that you need the love and support of those you can truly call your friends. We feel that support very strongly here tonight. We have chosen, Mark and I, to dream a big dream. And we know that it has meaning only as it comes to be shared by others. Here tonight, in my city of Jerusalem, I see our dream shining so brightly that I dare to hope it will light the world. I am an Israeli, born right here in Jerusalem, a new child in a place more ancient than the mind can imagine. Because I was born here, I am a child of conflict and contradiction. Knowing in my home the love that runs so deep in a Jewish family, but seeing in the streets around me the ugliness that comes from people declaring themselves to be mortal enemies. My family moved away from Jerusalem, so I haven't lived here for many years. But wherever I went, the scenes of conflict, the images of a torn city, burn in my memory. Then suddenly, a few months ago, as you know, I was plunged into the heart of terror. The nightmare returned more terrible than any fear I have ever known. But now tonight, on the eve of my wedding to this wonderful man who has come into my life, I can say that the ordeal of terror has become the greatest hope I have ever known. It's hope, no more than that. It's absolute conviction that even those who have declared themselves to be enemies to the point of death can find a pathway to peace. If we can show that understanding here in Jerusalem, if we can declare here a new beginning that puts an end to violence and shows no pattern need be endlessly repeated, if we can do that here in this eternal city, then we will have said to the world, it can be done. So these are my thoughts as I thank all of you for being here. My greatest wish is that tomorrow, all those who watch will see the truth of what we mean to do and choose also to embrace it with their hearts.
Before the end of the evening, Mark and Esther find themselves closeted with Israel's Minister of Defense, Chaim Shamir, and Colonel Greenberg. It's a strategy session for tomorrow. Greenberg has a contingency plan.
The enemy is set for one scenario. Now, we turn the tables on him by changing the setup at the last minute. The stage and shell there are fixed, but we've built a second stage on a motorized flatbed. It's concealed here in this tent behind the other one. At the last minute, we bring it out and drive it to the far end of the field. Then the ceremony continues as a mirror image of what the enemy had been expecting. The guests have been prepared for this with instructions in a sealed envelope, distributed as they arrive. They're told not to open the envelope unless directed. My men will be stationed all along in rows to see that everything goes smoothly. Most people will simply have to turn around to face the other way. The invited guests will be escorted to the center to new chairs brought out by my men as the stage is put into position. It'll all be done in 10 minutes, and the enemy will have the situation completely reversed on him.
Well, Mark recognizes that this is an ingenious and indeed brilliant plan, but he has some reservations, and he has one final request.
Now, one last point, Colonel. We have to work closely together to decide if we need to switch to the contingency plan.
That will require first-class communication lines. Then wire me up. That's a technical matter. You can do it. We can practically be inside each other's head from now until the wedding.
All right, Mr. Venture. We'll use an MCD, a miniaturized communication device. I'll get the equipment right now. We'll see how this works. But I'm the one who'll decide on the final course of action. Fine. Mark stands up and offers his hand to Mr. Shamir. Mr. Minister, it's good to know that you and your security forces are on hand. I believe tomorrow will be a great day for all of us.
Yes, Mr. Venture, I think so too. I'm sure Miss Fisher has told you that we Jews have an ancient prayer which says, next year in Jerusalem. This discussion has changed that. Now it's tomorrow in Jerusalem. And it's not just for the Jews, Mr. Minister. It's for the world. Tomorrow in Jerusalem. Yes, it has a good sound to it.
So, now we're ready for a truly memorable tomorrow in Jerusalem, as Mark Venture and Esther Fisher celebrate their marriage with the world watching.